All right, guys, it's Jim Costa from Cash the Ticket. And if you're betting college football bowl games, and that can be a dicey endeavor, we're the podcast for you. We're releasing breakdowns for every matchup with new episodes dropping almost every day. Subscribe to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KNX News 97.1 FM,
this is Countdown 2024.
Here are Charles Feldman and Margaret Carrero.
Well, 33 days to go. 33 days before Joe Biden departs the White House and Donald Trump moves in for a second run at America's top job. Thank you for counting down the days along with us. On today's Countdown 2024, Donald Trump and his allies have perfected the art of intimidation through lawsuits. And even before his second term has begun, the president-elect is already seeing the results of defamation threats. So we'll ask whether journalists and critics will be forced to cower. And even though it is technically guaranteed in the Constitution, should the Postal Service be handed over to private ownership? But first, this.
The continuing resolution in the House of Representatives that is meant to keep the government open and funded for 3 months is running into fierce opposition from Republicans in a sign of what is to come next year when the Republican majority will be even slimmer than it is now. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson is being bombarded with criticism from the most conservative elements of his caucus over what they see as too much spending in the funding bill. And Johnson also taking shots from billionaire Trump allies Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. Musk has even suggested letting the government shut down and stay closed until Donald Trump is sworn into office on January 20th. Now there's this. Donald Trump and his vice president-elect, J.D. Vance, just announced they're against the funding bill. They want an increase of the debt ceiling included. The federal government is due to run out of money by midnight Friday.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments in January that will challenge the ban of social media platform TikTok. Oral arguments are scheduled in front of the highest court in the land on January 10th. That's 9 days before the TikTok ban is set to go into effect. President-elect Trump, who 4 years ago indicated he was open to a national ban for TikTok, has since done an about-face and even met with the TikTok CEO that was at Mar-a-Lago. So, no matter how the Supreme Court case goes, the massively popular app might have a couple of available lifelines.
The Federal Reserve forecasting more stubborn inflation in 2025, which could spoil Donald Trump's promises of rapid economic growth once he takes office. The Fed trimmed interest rates today and is expected to continue on that track in the new year. But even with those steps, the nation's top economists are expecting prices of many goods and services to remain high. And then there's this. A lot of Trump's promised policies like sweeping tariffs on imported goods and mass deportations of illegal immigrants could turn out to be extremely inflationary for the American economy.
Donald Trump has always been, well, how should we put this, a extremely litigious guy, never meeting a lawsuit he didn't like. But with his second election win and with his determination to exact revenge on his critics, Trump is leaning hard into his legal intimidation tactics. Richard Toefel was a veteran journalist at several news outlets and served as president of the nonprofit investigative journalism organization ProPublica. He is now author of the second rough draft Substack column. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Charles.
You know, the insidious part of these lawsuits and or even threats of lawsuits is really not that it matters whether Trump wins or loses. In fact, he's lost a number of these over the years. It's the mere either threat or the actual lawsuit that can wreak havoc on either a news organization or a news reporter, yes?
It can, although I think it's important not to get carried away here. We have in this country, at least to this moment, the strongest press protections under the law of any country in the world, certainly any major country in the world. And that remains true. And I think, at least to this moment, Trump's ability to intimidate the press is been a bit overrated. His ability to cause them to spend money defending cases, yes. But actually deterring coverage, I don't quite see that yet.
You were shocked, though. You wrote, I believe it was on Substack, shocked by ABC News agreeing to settle Trump's defamation suit. Why?
So this was in the Columbia Journalism Review, Margaret, but you're absolutely right. I was shocked because I still believe, based on everything I know for a fact, that ABC was more likely to win this case eventually than to lose it, and that the damages to Trump, which is not a subject I got into in the piece, but that the damages to Trump, even if he did win, would be quite limited. Now, as I tried to say in the piece, the one thing we don't know, or one big thing we don't know, is whether ABC had a problem that it knew about, but that we don't, and they haven't disclosed that, and that remains a possibility.
Okay, but ABC has got a lot of money, and a lot of news organizations, especially nowadays, do not, especially independent investigative journalists. So isn't, again, to go back to my original question, the threat of a lawsuit, which Mr. Trump does in the past, he has carried out. He doesn't just make threats. He often files the lawsuits, win or lose. But if you're not ABC, if you're not CBS, if you're not some, you know, the New York Times, might this not really have a freezing effect?
It could. And I think it's something very much to be concerned about. But the major news organizations, and this is why I was very concerned about the ABC result, the major news organizations need to, and heretofore have, stood up to him. He filed a suit, for instance, against Bloomberg that he later admitted he did, even though he didn't think he would win, just to cost the reporter money. But he did ultimately lose the case. Bloomberg forced him to defend it and proved that its story was true.
We are currently speaking with Richard Toefel, former president of ProPublica, now author of the second Rough Draft Substack column. You know, Trump has made no secret about how he feels about the media, calling reporters the enemy of the people. I mean, the job of a journalist, of a reporter, is to hold those in power to account. But if you have the president of the United States constantly casting doubt on the accuracy of the reporting, the truthfulness of their reporting, what does that mean for the future of journalism?
Well, he's clearly determined to try to undermine people's trust in journalism. And I think the numbers would suggest that he has had some success in doing that. Although paradoxically, we do live in a situation where people tend to trust the news themselves, that they themselves consume, and not to trust the news that other people consume. So it's a little bit more complicated.
What is the remedy, though? Because I think you're right. I think that the sort of Trump effect in terms of people's mistrust of at least mainstream media has noticeably declined. The polls, I think, would indicate that since Trump has been in office. So what's the remedy?
I think the only remedy here is for the press to continue to do its job, for the press, for the news organizations that can afford robust defense to continue to mount them, particularly when their stories are accurate. And as I say, it may be that ABC had a legal problem here that it's not yet disclosed. And also for the news industry as a whole, and also the legal profession, to make sure that smaller organizations get the resources that they need to defend themselves, again, when their stories are accurate and valid.
You had mentioned earlier that you don't see this changing the way Trump is covered. Is that right?
Well, no, I mean, I think there is some concern, right? There is an alternative hypothesis here that the Disney company, one of the richest companies in the country, has just capitulated for no particularly good reason to the president of the United States. That would be enormously concerning. The Disney, there are a number of questions here that Disney needs to answer about this case, ABC needs to answer, and that they simply have not answered.
I mean, what do you want to hear from them?
What I want to hear from them is whether they found any evidence in their own files that caused them to settle the case. What I want to hear from them is whether their continued aggressive coverage of Trump, if they did have a problem in their own files, I want to hear from them what they're doing about disciplining the people who cost their shareholders this money. Those are three questions.
Well, but since we're going down this hypothetical road, let's go down a little bit further then. Because you're suggesting that maybe there was something that ABC was trying to hide from the public. But on the surface, it seems like it was a pretty straightforward thing. You had an anchor who said something. Trump claimed that it was technically inaccurate, and ABC caved. What sorts of things might there be that would have any impact on that scenario?
Well, the great thing about our law is that it protects you unless you knowingly tell a falsehood. And it has to be a significant falsehood. As you said, Charles, the inaccuracy in this was quite technical. We can get into it if you want. But it was quite technical. As long as there is nothing in their files that said, oh, who cares, let's just make this technical mistake, they should win this case. Now, there have been a few cases over the years when people have made that mistake, cast that doubt on what they themselves were saying. But there's a mystery here, I think, more than a clear resolution. And people who are jumping to one conclusion or another, ABC caved or ABC is covering up, I just don't think we know the truth about what happened here yet.
Richard Toefel, veteran journalist, as we said, served as president for ProPublica and is author of The Second Rough Draft. That is a Substack column. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Donald Trump says he wants to try again to privatize the Postal Service. Can his plan work? We'll talk about that next.
It's Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM. This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Welcome back to the show. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Margaret Carrero. Donald Trump has complained about the U.S. Postal Service for years. During his first term in office, he complained that the USPS had been far too generous with delivery contracts for Amazon. Then, leading up to the 2020 election, Trump started spinning conspiracy theories about the Postal Service somehow manipulating mail-in ballots. The president-elect has repeatedly referred to the constitutionally enshrined Postal Service as a loser. That's a quote. So it came with little surprise when he said this week he's considering plans to privatize the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah, the Postal Service is not necessarily known for being an efficient government agency. It consistently runs operating deficits. So could there be a potential benefit in privatizing it? Art Sackler is president of the Coalition for a 21st Century Postal Service. That's an advocacy group representing commercial mail users. Art, thanks for being with us.
Margaret, Charles, good to be with you.
So here's the thing, Art. I dare say that I don't think I know anybody who doesn't have something bad to say about the Postal Service. And that's not to demean the people who work there. I'm sure they're all really fine people that do as best a job as they can. But over the years, I know, like, my mail, I used to get it delivered in the morning. Now I'm lucky if I get it at 8 or 9 o'clock at night. I get mail that belongs to other people. They get mail that belongs to me. What has happened to the Postal Service?
Well, over the last 20 years, maybe, the amount of mail and later packages that have been in the system have declined, particularly mail. Postal Service cites a number of saying in 1997, I think it is, they had 99 billion pieces of mail. And now it's gone, first-class mail, and now it's down. Single-piece first-class is down.
Yeah, it's down. So why isn't it easier
exactly
to deliver the mail, and why isn't the postal system then more efficient because they don't have as much stuff to deliver to begin with?
Well, because their volume's going down and the number of addresses they deliver to every year is going up by more than a million, you can see where that can rapidly lead to not enough money. Now, having said that, there have also been some unfunded government mandates that they've had to pay. And there hasn't, as a result, been enough money for them to invest in upgrading their physical plant, in replacing, God knows, their vehicles, which are now 10, 20 years past their useful lives, and sometimes spontaneously combust. So it's a combination of things. And let me add in one other, and that is that, you know, you have, as part of the reason for losing all this mail, you have this huge secular shift, if you will, a shift from paper to digital in terms of communications. And that just keeps going. So that contributes to the Postal Service too. But it's mainly a loss of business and revenues. And this is the last thing that you need to know about why they are where they are. They have not contained their costs well enough. This is a people-driven organization, if you will. Something like 75 to 80% of their costs are for their people.
Okay, Back in 2018, when the same idea of privatization of the Postal Service was being floated by the first Trump administration, you said from your group standpoint, privatization is not the answer. So what is the answer?
Well, I don't know exactly what the answer would be, but if you do privatization and you look at the examples overseas, you see prices go way up. And I don't mean just 70 cents. I mean, for example, 3.5 euros in places like Italy or in Great Britain. Just yesterday, the Royal Mail was bought by a Czech billionaire. And so service typically goes down, it slows dramatically, and prices go up. And that's not good for anybody, especially those who live in rural areas or difficult to get to urban or suburban areas.
We are speaking with Art Sackler, president of the Coalition for a 21st Century Postal Service, about this idea of possibly privatizing the USPS. We'll continue our conversation next.
This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Welcome back to the Wednesday edition of Countdown 2024. Along with Margaret Carrero, I'm Charles Feldman.
Art Sackler with the advocacy group Coalition for a 21st Century Postal Service remains with us to discuss possibly privatizing your local post office.
So, Art, if privatizing the mail system, as you just pointed out, inevitably, it seems, leads to higher prices and worse service, keeping the current system is also pretty bad service for the most part, and prices also are going up. What then are we left with? Do we just let UPS and FedEx take care of the large packages and pretty much do everything digitally now and forget about the mail?
No, I don't think that's the case. What you have to do, what I addressed was, you know, this gross sense of privatization, a sweeping sale or a spinoff. You won't get private sector folks to buy pieces of this postal system, which is another huge obstacle to privatization. But there are, and we are waiting to see what the incoming Trump administration will define privatization as. There are pieces of privatization that would help in a big way. What the Postal Service spends the most money on is its so-called middle mile. You know, you drop something at the post office or the carrier comes and picks it up at your house, takes it back, puts it in the system for processing, and then that's transportation and sorting and all that stuff. And then it's delivered on the so-called last mile. Nobody can replace that last mile efficiently for every address in the United States. Too many that are too far away. They just aren't profitable. The first mile, post offices from your house, that's great. But outsourcing, contracting out as much of the middle mile as possible would save the Postal Service a huge amount of money. Now, whether that would save enough, I don't know. We'd have to see what the calculus would be, but it would save a lot because the theory would be that the private sector could move that mail and those packages from the first mile to the last mile rather than leaving it in the hands of the Postal Service. And many of the huge mailers, the big banks, the big retail outlets, utilities, whatever you might want to say, insurance, they could take all that mail that they prepare in their own plants, do their own transportation, and drop it at a delivery unit or near to a delivery unit at the other end.
All right, Art, we're going to have to leave it at that. We're running out of time. Art Sackler with the advocacy group Coalition for a 21st Century Postal Service. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Art. Coming up on tomorrow's Countdown 2024, back in 2016, when Donald Trump won his first election, the reaction among most tech industry leaders in Silicon Valley was to keep their distance. After the January 6th insurrection, tech moguls like Mark Zuckerberg, they were quick to condemn Trump. Well, flash forward 4 years, tech giants are tripping all over themselves to get close to Mr. Trump. So what changed? That's tomorrow's show. If you miss it, catch up on demand on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Search Countdown 2024 and follow the show.